When my sister and I were small, our favorite stopping place when we took a car ride was Lindsay's Ice Cream Parlor, where she usually bought a single-dip peppermint cone for a nickel, and I bought the best lemon ice cream in the world. Sundays were special because in the afternoon we had our weekly treat, a huge double-dip cone for double the price, 10 cents. I remembered only because I realized this morning that you have a two-scoop sundae coming up. First, next week, you get to hear Dr. Jim Kelly preach in my absence. And those who heard him last time know this is a treat. He's going to speak on the subject, "Tis the Season," which is a reflection on the Advent season and how we can use it to make personal preparation for celebrating Christmas. And second, in the evening, you have a chance to take part in the Hanging of the Greens, an extremely pleasant all-church get-together with decorating jobs for the kids and excellent food and fellowship for the adults. I tried very hard to schedule a necessary trip so that I could be here, and I couldn't. I hope all of you have better luck. I would like to add my greetings just for a moment to all our visitors. I have not even met all of them, but I did become aware that John Kaiser is proud and happy to be sitting beside his niece, Cindy. I know that there are Wakefield and Warren children home for the holidays. Welcome to all of you, to the Bob Martin family, whom I noticed a few minutes ago. We're always happy to have you here. Out in the middle of the southwestern desert, close to the Rio Grande River, there is a small New Mexico town with the intriguing name of Truth or Consequences. It was known once upon a time as Hot Springs because it had one. But 40 years ago, it played host to a live radio broadcast of a popular game show, and it liked the publicity so much that it adopted the name of the program. It's quite a mouthful to say, so the natives usually call it T or C, and each spring they celebrate with a fiesta the fame Ralph Edwards brought to them. I suppose Edwards named his show from a game some of us played as children in that ancient time before there was television or vacation Bible school, and we had to entertain ourselves. As I recall it, we would ask someone an embarrassing question and then threaten with truth or consequences. If one came out with the truth, nothing happened. If not, we dreamed up some humiliating ordeal which had to be endured as a consequence. Well, all those kids, Jack and Charles and Dwight and Phyllis and Ruth, are scattered and mostly forgotten, playing now at older games. But even if we no longer play truth or consequences, we live it. Every single day, there is a truth about gravity. Either we honor it or we step off a high place and hurt ourselves. There is a truth about constant anxiety and stress. Either we obey it or we get ulcers or high blood pressure as a consequence. And in the moral universe, there is an inexorable law of cause and effect, even when the proof is long delayed. There is a declaration in Paul's letter to the Galatian church so ominous, I think we really prefer not to hear it. Whatever a person sows, so shall the harvest be. We reap what we sow. Keep in mind that prison is not the only penalty. And ask Michael Milken, ask Michael Beaver, ask Jimmy Swaggart, ask Jimmy Baker, ask my former student Kim Dewey, ask me, ask yourself. The observed punishment may seem too light for the crime, but the legal punishment is only part of what happens. You know things about yourself that diminish you, and there is no escape. So it is not that the harvest is always visible, but that you can count on it. There is always a harvest. Cheat people habitually, and on top of what the law may do, your own mental world shrinks to a dwarfish doubt that anyone else is honest. You may lie so easily and cleverly that no obvious punishment ever comes, but the lying makes you suspect everyone else of doing what you do, so that the beautiful thing called trust vanishes from your life. Punishment enough, perhaps. If that's too subtle to deter some of us, there is another consequence of lying. At least I found that out by the time I was 10, and my experience could not have been unique. I discovered that if I lied to one person to get out of a jam, I had to tell two lies the next day to keep people from finding out about the first one. And the next day, it took four lies to cover up the two I had covered up with the day before. And by the time the third day came, I couldn't remember which lie I had told to which person. And the roof caved in. But I'm not interested in the matter simply of telling the truth this morning. I'm interested in how we discover it. Because the failure to figure out how to distinguish truth from falsehood can make us so vulnerable that we are wounded over and over. I think every child should be taught by some teaching trick suitable to the child's age what the four major stumbling blocks are to the discovery of truth. They happen to be Roger Bacon's from the 13th century, but it takes no genius to make the list. One of them is reliance on the wrong expert. If I have a hobby horse about school curricula, this is it: that every student should have an intensive course in how to discriminate among those who profess to know. When almost anybody can tack up a diploma, pose in print or on television as an expert, how do you figure out the fraudulent? Anyone can hang up a shingle. How do we find out which ones are sound? How do we know which political candidate really does have the better case? Every preacher makes a good argument for the doctrines of his church. How do we separate truth from tradition? Do you really think It's more admirable to be a placid sheep than to become an intelligent critic. We're also kept from discovering truth by our reliance on custom and convention. What was good and useful once must always be good and useful. What has been held true for centuries is as comfortable as an old shoe. It's disturbing to raise questions, to ruffle feathers, to ask why. Why? A young Polish scientist named Copernicus doubts what the world has believed for 1,400 years, convinced by the evidence he sees that the planets orbit the sun. Well, the smart money bet against him, lost eventually, but delayed the game a while. About 35 years ago, a church in Wichita held a public burning of the Revised Standard Version of the Bible because it dared to differ with the old King James, which had been around for 350 years. Not a soul around that holy bonfire knew that the King James itself was attacked for over 100 years because it was different from the versions that came before it. How many good things struggle to be born amidst a chorus of frightened songs. We've never heard it like that. We've never done it that way. Then it doesn't help matters to find out that part of our difficulty with truth is that we actually seem to enjoy being lied to about some things. The most ignorant man expects his friends to perpetuate the fiction that he's clever. The most conniving and manipulative woman wants to hear that she is fair and unselfish. Have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? The Apostle Paul asked plaintively. Well, the answer to that often is yes. We like to hide behind what somebody called guiding fictions, illusions we find useful. Come on, tell me the truth, our friend begs us. We tell it and often find ourselves minus one friend. We want the teacher to tell us that Johnny is a slow-blooming genius when we know perfectly well he's only the first part. We want to believe that the Sunday school teachers have failed woefully when Susie gets into trouble, despite what we know about all our mistakes at home. We want with all our hearts to believe the noble reasons for rushing off to Saudi Arabia. Perhaps in that hypothetical course of mine, every student should be taught deliberately to distrust almost anything that he wants desperately to believe. People who know what we want to believe can tell us a lie or a half-truth successfully. They can manipulate because of our desires in whatever ways are advantageous to them. Machiavelli advised people going into politics to pretend to be religious, but never really to be religious, because the pretense of religion will win supporters and cost him nothing, while an actual commitment to religion cripples a ruler by making him have to keep his promise tell the truth, temper his greed, moderate his lust for power. Shakespeare caught that Machiavellian character brilliantly in his King Richard III, who struck a pious, Bible-quoting stance for the public, while privately planning to murder all his closest relatives and friends. "With a piece of scripture," he said, "I clothe my naked villainy. With old odd ends stolen out of holy writ, and seem a saint when most I play the devil." If you think that is remote and has no relevance for your own life, let me ask you a question. How many times have you given all sorts of reasons for your anger except the real one? How many times have you caught yourself in some stern moral judgment of another person when all of a sudden you saw the embarrassing truth that what was really wrong was that you were eaten up inside with envy? I had a dinner one evening years ago with a couple in their 60s who had been dating each other with some frequency for 3 or 4 years. The woman, refined and sensitive in deportment, told me she had just spent the day in tears because someone at her apartment complex had drawn the leering inference that her gentleman friend had been calling for her a couple of times a week at her apartment and who knows what. She said, "Why do people gossip like that? And what am I supposed to do?" My answer to the first question was that people gossip like that because they are secretly envious of a life that seems more exciting than their own. They never call it envy, of course. They call it righteous indignation. And that deception is so irritating that my answer to her second question, "What should I do?" was probably not very ministerial. I said, "Tell your friend to come 4 times a week and stay longer. That will keep you too busy to talk to people who gossip." Righteous indignation. How often that is simply a lie we tell ourselves to hide from the real motive, which it would shame us to admit. Which leads me finally to the lies we tell ourselves. I think of times in a counseling session when I finally had to stop the monologue. "You know, we can't get anywhere without the truth. Are you really being truthful?" And how often there would be a moment of embarrassed silence and then the confession, "No, I'm not," which sent us off in a promising new direction. I think we tell ourselves all kinds of lies about freedom. The famous acid head of the 60s, Timothy O'Leary, looking back the other day, said that, quote, "In the 60s, we were young, romantic, naive, and sometimes obnoxious, but we were right. I regret nothing." Most of us think there were some things to regret. We decided that drugs were acceptable, that sex need not be responsible, that authorities were useless. Newsweek said in 1967, "The old taboos are dead or dying. The people are breaking the bonds of Puritan society and helping America to grow up." That sounds a little hollow now. There were some good things out of that decade, but there was also some blind and irresponsible folly, and we are still paying a price. A drug war we seem unable to win, blossoming crime that has mothers buying bulletproof vests for toddlers, uninhabitable neighborhoods, children having children in tragic teenage pregnancies, casual abortion, swelling welfare rolls, an epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases, neglect of community, countless ruined lives. How blithely we chose our own way. We did not want anything in those years as firm as a commandment or a guideline, nothing that sounded like, "This is the way, walk in it." We thought freedom was actually free. We forgot for a while that obligation and restraint and denial are the only roads to freedom. Freedom without discipline, rights without responsibilities, self-fulfillment without the necessity of committing ourselves, it did not work. It does not. We loved to quote, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Oh, glorious freedom," we shouted. But we overlooked the condition that came before. "If you are my disciples, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." If you're under 20 in this room, I know how predictable and preachery that sounds. Forgive me. I have lived so long, I now believe it.